Welcome to the Farm to Table Talk podcast, where we talk about our food system from what we eat to how it's grown. I'm your host, Roger Wasson. Well, everyone should come to the table, and we are a table, Farm to Table Talk, but this invitation is and suggestion comes from none other than Tamar Haspel. And Tamar is a writer who farms, or a farmer who writes. And Tamar, I'm going to ask you to kind of make that distinction, because you are looked to by a lot of people, and they're watching what you say and what you write. In the meantime, you're out involved, getting your hands dirty, as you say sometimes, and in many aspects of farming. Welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, so answer the question for me, if you would. Are you a writer who farms or a farmer who writes?
I think I'm definitely a writer who farms. I've been a writer for a long time, for a good 20 years now, and mostly about food. And until about 8 years ago, from Manhattan. And, you know, my husband and I ended up moving to Cape Cod, essentially by accident. And we started to look around us and say, okay, well, what can we do in Cape Cod that we couldn't do in Manhattan? The answer is all kinds of things. And one of the things that we started to do was look at oyster farming. We happened to know some people who did it, and we got pretty interested in it. And my husband did a one-year apprenticeship with a local farmer, and then we were in the right place at the right time to be able to get a lease and start our own farm. And, you know, meanwhile, at home, we've done things like, you know, we have chickens and we've had turkeys and ducks and pigs and bees, and we grow things and we hunt and we fish, and we basically try and stay connected to the idea that food has to come from someplace. But the only commercial part of our operation is the oyster farm. And my husband is definitely a farmer-in-chief, and I'm the muscle. I go out on days when there's a lot of work to be done. But I really find that growing a crop for money is something that is very different from other kinds of food production. And since I write about agriculture, I mean, at first blush, it doesn't seem like there's a lot in common between oyster farming and, say, you know, farming 10,000 acres of corn and soy in the Midwest. But there's actually more than you'd think. There's disease and weather and risk management and hard work. And I think that not only does it, you know, keep me outside, keep me active, but it really does inform the work that I do.
You know, I don't know the first thing about oyster farming.
I didn't either until pretty recently.
So, I mean, what do you do? You don't go get oyster seeds and stick them in the ground. So, I mean,
well, actually, it's kind of like that. You don't put them in the ground. Obviously, you put them in the water. But we buy, and they call it oyster seed, even though it's
baby
oysters. Yes.
Yeah.
And we can buy them, you know, as small as, about 2 millimeters. They look like, you know, the head of a pin. Mm-hmm. And it is our job to put them in the water, to keep them safe from predators, and to keep the maximum amount of water flowing around them, because they get food from the water. And so basically oyster farming is putting oysters in an endless series of bags and trays, and managing your density so that you don't have too many, so they get crowded or misshapen or insufficiently fed, but that you have enough to make a living. And that's what we do. It takes 2 seasons for an oyster to reach market size here. So, you know, we get our seed in spring of year one, and we start selling that crop in fall of year two. And in between, it's just a lot of lugging rocks around, because oysters get really heavy.
Oh, yeah.
And we have to move them quite a bit.
So you just put them in big bags of water? I had assumed that you had to have an ocean or a lake or something.
No, you do. You put them in bags in the water.
Oh.
And so our our operation, and people do it in different ways in different parts of the world, in different parts of the country, in different parts of Cape Cod. And so basically our farm is, or the part of the farm where we're growing our oysters from start to finish is intertidal, so it's dry at low tide. And there are cages that are about 4 feet by 3 feet on legs spread across the lease that we have, and the oysters are in the cages, and then on top of those cages are stiff bags that have the smaller oysters, because when they're smaller, you have to protect them from predators, so we can't put them in open cages.
Well, that's incredible, and it takes that long. Now, when I see people advertising oysters, and when they're at restaurants, and they advertise them being certain, you know, from this region or that region, I mean, can you get the oyster seeds from different desirable locations and grow them yourself?
It doesn't quite work that way. All of the oysters on the East Coast are the same species of oyster, the eastern oyster, Crabs Austria virginica, and there aren't that many places that are hatcheries where you can buy seed. Now there are some growers who do seed as a side business, but there are only a couple of, you know, all in hatcheries. And a lot of growers buy the seed from the same place, but then you put that seed in the water that you have, and it's the water that really determines what those oysters end up tasting like. Now, there are things that you can control. You have some control over what shape the oysters are going to be, depending on how you manage them. But, you know, there's a heavy genetic component to that as well. But when you see those, you know, this is a Blue Point, this is a Wellfleet, it's not so much where the seed comes from, it's where the oyster grows up, because that's what determines what it tastes like.
Wow. Now, do people, say a restaurant, would they advertise the fact that it's from your farm, or is it more of the variety or the type of oyster that is what they can market to get a premium?
It's a little bit of both. The name of our company is Barnstable Oyster, and we grow oysters in the town of Barnstable. But any grower who is in the town of Barnstable can call their oysters Barnstable oysters. So there's, you know, it's not a people sometimes think that they've eaten oysters from our farm, when in reality they've eaten oysters from our town. But it's a relatively small town, and there, you know, there aren't that many growers who are growing here. And we were fortunate in that we have a harbor, we have a shallow harbor that happens to be spectacular for growing oysters. It has a big tide. It has a lot of nutrients rushing in and out. It just has conditions that are just primo for oyster growth. And we happen to be able to grow some of the best oysters around. And I don't take credit for that, because, of course, it's the water. But if you see Barnstable oysters on the menu, by all means, you have to give them a try.
You know, I just have one more question about the water issue. I mean, there's some areas of the world that have very bad water, that there's heavy pollution. Does that impact the oysters themselves if it's an area that, say, has heavy metals or other pollution issues? Does that affect them?
Yes, it does. And you can't eat oysters out of those areas if they have toxins that can affect humans, that accumulate in the oyster. On the other hand, what you can do is put oysters in places like that, and oysters can help clean the water. They help filter the water, and also sometimes they can sequester toxins in their feces and something like they call pseudo feces. And it can sequester the toxins in the silt at the bottom of the water, at the seafloor. But then, in order to eat them, you have to take them out of that water, put them someplace else that has clean water for a little while, and let them work those things out of their bodies, and then they can be safe for consumption.
Boy, I can't believe how much I don't know. This is
I know. Well, I've been doing it for 5 years, and I can't believe how much I don't know either. So we're in the same boat.
Well, let's switch to something else that we both know a little bit about, and that is... media, and conversations about food. One of the things I'm so kind of inspired by what you do is that you are trying to promote conversations yourself, like I try to in a small way with these podcasts, conversations about our food and how it's grown. You mentioned earlier you've been a writer for years, and you know now the farmer side too. You've just been explaining. You're writing a column for the Washington Post once a month. How did that come to happen? There's a whole lot of writers around the country wish the Washington Post would give them a ring and say, would you write an article? How did you come to get into that position with the Post, and what is it that you're doing for them?
Well, I'll always remember the very first story I wrote for the Washington Post, and it was soon after we had moved to Cape Cod, and we designed and built a chicken coop in the backyard. And remember, we're fresh off the boat from Manhattan. We don't know a chicken coop from a hole in the ground. And so we do this chicken coop, and we get chickens, and we're kind of marveling at the whole idea that we have chickens in our backyard. And, of course, the eggs start coming, and we start eating eggs, and I'm delighted to be eating these eggs from our backyard chickens. But it occurs to me that, you know, I've read all the time about how backyard eggs taste better, they taste different. And as much as I get satisfaction from eating these eggs, they kind of just tasted like eggs to me. And so we did literally a blind taste test where we blindfolded people, because backyard eggs look different from the eggs that you get in the store. They have kind of a stand-up bright orange yolk. But we figured, okay, so we have to take away all the visual cues. So we did this blind tasting of backyard eggs compared to supermarket eggs, compared to organic eggs. And it turned out nobody could tell the difference. The finding was all eggs taste the same. And I sent that story. I had never written for the Washington Post, and I sent that story article, a query, a pitch for it, to Joe Yonan, who is the food editor, the excellent food editor at the Washington Post. And he liked it. He bought it. And then I started writing for them pretty regularly. And then, you know, it seemed to me that there were a lot of misconceptions flying around about different aspects of our food system. People were starting to get interested in where their food came from, and it looked like, you know, that people were sort of hanging on to narratives that weren't really completely factual about things like GMOs and organics and pesticides and you know, free range and animal welfare, and it seemed to me that there was room for a fact-checking kind of a column. So I pitched that to Joe, and I about swallowed my tongue when he bought it. It's not every day somebody gives you a column in the Washington Post. But we were off to the races. And then since then, we've covered all kinds of issues, and it has been a fascinating ride. I've learned so much, and I've talked to so many interesting people in every facet of agriculture. So I consider myself extremely fortunate.
Well, congratulations. I mean, I've seen many of your articles, and they're really well done. I'm curious, when you put that kind of story in the Washington Post, what are you learning about what people care about? I mean, do they do, like, readership surveys to be able to determine, you know, that one was read a lot, but, you know, this one you didn't really hit the mark, and it didn't prove as interesting?
Absolutely.
So what are you learning?
Well, people, unsurprisingly, people care most about issues that affect them. And so the stories that have gotten the most traffic are the stories that hit people where they live. And you know, there was one story that I wrote, I think it was last year, about how salad is overrated. And I make the case that, you know, iceberg lettuce isn't the best use of our agricultural resources. And that one, I think that was my only column to genuinely go viral. People really cared about salad. And, you know, just last month I wrote about tilapia. And again, that's something that people care a lot about. You know, but one of the great things about writing for the Washington Post is that they don't measure the quality of journalism solely by how many hits a piece gets. They're really interested in covering the issues that are a little wonkier, that are important to a smaller segment of the population. And people do care about how food is produced. People do care about things like honeybees and chicken welfare and GMOs and organic agriculture and all kinds of things. And you know, those don't get the huge flood of readership that salad gets. But I think that there's a solid core of people, and it's growing, who really care about those kinds of things.
When you say the people really care, I'm just curious. My guess is it might be more women than men. I don't know. I don't mean to be sexist to say that. That's my instinct. Would that be true, do you think, or is it there no difference?
I don't know. That's really interesting.
Probably doesn't matter. I suppose. And the other thing, just being the Washington Post, I would assume that readers of the Washington Post are a higher percentage of college educated than people that don't read newspapers.
That's probably true.
And so, you know, that plays into it, too. It's really fascinating.
And, you know, but you know, you raise a point that is important in another way, and that is that I think that there are a lot of conversations that happen in the public space around food that aren't terribly constructive. And some of it is rooted in genuine disagreement. But some of it seems more to be a cultural divide than a food-related divide. And, yeah, I write for the Washington Post, and there's a perception the people who are talking about policy in the food world tend to be these coastal media elites who are at least stereotypically left-leaning, whereas the people who are actually growing our food are rural, heartland. Farmers tend to skew more to the right, whereas journalists tend to skew more to the left, and that this divide that you just touched on is one of the things that makes talking about food sort of difficult and you know, rife with, you know, at the ends of this electoral season, it's hard to call anything vitriolic that falls short of the standard we have set in the presidential election.
That's right.
But there's some downright unpleasantness in those conversations.
Yeah. When you think of the stories that you've written, mm-hmm. And the ones that end up going viral, or I assume the story is on the... you know, you've got it in the newspaper itself, and then they also post it online. Some of them, I suppose, gets a lot more activity online and has a life of its own and ends up getting retweeted all over the place. Have there been any surprises? And again, I guess this is being a little redundant because I asked you earlier what you're learning from what's going, but there been any surprises in those things that seem to have more legs on social media than the website than the printed version?
To some extent, it's a little bit of a black box to me, and I don't have a good handle on what is going to be popular and what isn't going to be popular.
Hmm.
And the joke I have with my editor is that last year, I wrote a piece about how we might tackle some of the problems in the farm bill. And I made the case that one of the straightforward things we could do is insure all crops to the same extent. So
mm-hmm.
you know, we subsidize crop premiums. Why don't we just do that to the same extent for all crops so we don't build incentives for particular crops into the farm bill? Because that got us into all kinds of trouble, you know, back when we started doing it, which is, you know,
right.
60 years ago. And so I wrote this whole thing about how we should, you know, all gather around the idea of crop neutral insurance. And I thought I could get people to care about this. And of course nobody did. And anybody who had any sense of what people like could have told me that nobody would. But you know, I still laugh about this idea that there are things that I want to be able to make people care about, and I can't really. And I think that it's way more important to be able to capture people's attention with something that they do care about, and then leverage that attention into issues that are important. And there are some journalists who are very skilled at that, and I wish I were more so.
Well, you know, you had an interesting way of referring to policymaking. It looks to me, instead of used to say it was, you know, like looking at sausage being made or something, but you talked about it running the zoo and said
if I were in charge.
And I don't run the zoo.
Did you have
but
that book when you were a kid? If I ran the zoo, it
no.
was a children's book.
Oh, and so you say I don't run the zoo. I can sit at my desk and tell those who you can't sit at your desk and tell those who run the zoo what to do. But you didn't let that put you back any, because you said I have some ideas that could be a starting point, and you shared some.
Well, you know, that's my job, to mm-hmm. have ideas that could be a starting point. And you know, I think that agriculture is a really, really complex world. Even just understanding the farm bill, let alone anything else, is incredibly complicated. And I think all of us who have the latitude to express some opinion in our journalism have to be really circumspect about, you know, bringing ideas to the table, because they're always downsides you don't think of. They're always complications that you don't foresee.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do try and put ideas forward with the sort of the caveat that I need a whole lot of input from a whole lot of people who know a whole lot of things that I don't before I'm willing to say this is a good idea.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I think you've identified areas that raise good questions. You've talked about, in this area, you've talked about subsidies, mm-hmm. cover crops, mm-hmm. The Farm Service Administration, conservation efforts, good farming practices, longer-term leases, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of areas that are important. So when you can plant the seeds, or you can get those ideas talked about, is it your hope that some citizens will take those to heart and say something to their congressman?
Well, you know, I would say that in a general way, it is my hope, as I suspect it is every journalist's hope, that we can have some sort of impact on the conversation by trying to write about what's true, by trying to understand this world and translate it for people who don't have the luxury of spending all day every day reading about food and agriculture mm-hmm. and boring their family and their friends witless. And so I guess that's what I would hope. I would hope that the work that I do can inform the conversation about food and food policy in a way that is positive and constructive.
And if you do, then I suppose that it will be somebody's going to say, well, that was a good idea. And, you know, if it's a constituent of a congressman, or if it's if it requires federal policy, somebody's going to have to make a motion and add an amendment to the farm bill in a committee and stick it in the farm bill and Congress vote on it and the president sign it.
The day that crop neutral insurance becomes part of the negotiations for the farm bill, it will warm my heart, let me tell you.
It's going to be tomorrow's crop neutral insurance plan. Well, we're knowing that we got that. Maybe we're going to get it started here. Somebody might be listening to this and saying, oh, yeah, I almost forgot. I'm going to work.
Everybody got that crop neutral insurance.
You know, if you you were going to have a wish right now, if you were looking down the road and saying, boy, I really wish that this would get tackled in this next year. Is there something related to food policy, food ideas, food understanding, this whole nexus between farming and, you know, like the farm to table movement, are there some things that are on your wish list?
Yeah,
in that space.
What's on my wish list? What's on my wish list is that this food conversation that basically breaks down into sides, and on the one side we have, you know, conventional agriculture, growing conventional crops, commodity crops on a lot of acres, feeding them to pigs and cars, whose watchword is efficiency, who are just growing an incredible amount of food. And then on the other hand, you have the small, urban, organic or organic-ish, diverse, local people who farm that way and who are proponents of that kind of farming. I want those two sides to be in the same room. I want all conferences to include people who are not part of the agenda of the one side or the other. I want those people to have panel discussions and to talk to each other face to face, because I travel in both of those circles, and it just seems to me that I find people who really care about feeding people, who care about doing it responsibly, who care about, you know, minimal environmental impact, who care about nutritional completeness for the developing world. I find those people on both sides of this controversy, and it just seems to me there's a great deal of common ground, and I really wish that these two sides could have a better relationship, because I think that's how we could really talk about constructive solutions to the very real problems we have growing food in this country.
Well, sign me up.
Okay, you and me.
I'm in. I'm in. I'm with you on that one. I just think that it's so important, and I go through the same thing myself, that I just can't believe that we have people that are are just feel like they're such extremes, and get in conversations all the time, and also ends up being almost arguments, because they're trying to point out that there's so much in common, and some people just don't want to accept the fact that there is that so much in common, you know. And in fact, you've got, you know, some of the smaller people that are getting started have needed to get bigger. And so in some respects, you could say they're needing to become a little more industrial, if you will, which is a bad word, but to many. But still, they got to accomplish certain scale. And then you've got some certain conventional farmers that are becoming, you know, going into organic a little bit, or kind of modifying their operation. And I think that they're moving in the same direction, but they're not necessarily talking.
And, you know, there's certainly I don't mind the word industrialization of agriculture, because when you homogenize it in the way that it has been homogenized to focus on just a few crops, and you heavily mechanize it so you can do a whole lot of work with not a whole lot of people, I have no problem calling that industrialized, and I don't use it pejoratively. But there are problems with that kind of agriculture, and there are problems with the other kind of agriculture. But the thing is, we have this pressing problem, and that is a growing population of people, all of whom need to eat. And we need all of the tools that we have. We need all of the methods that we have, because some are going to be appropriate for some situations, others for other situations. And, you know, it just seems that the conversation is always either or, your way or my way. And we need both ways.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I think you said it very, very well. And I'm thinking that if people hear you saying that, hear it on the podcast, see it in the various stories and places that you're giving presentations, that there will be some people that will take that to mind, because you've given a fairly straightforward prescription of if you have anything to say about a conversation taking place or a meeting or a conference, make sure that there's some from both sides and listen respectfully and look for the common themes.
Well, and, you know, it's funny because I'm certainly not the only one saying this. In fact, in my travels, I have found that when you talk to farmers, they're the first people to acknowledge the shortcomings of their system, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
When I talk to scientists, to academics who study this stuff, always an acknowledgement that we need, there are trade-offs to everything, and we need all of the tools at our disposal. When I talk to policymakers at the USDA, there's a deep understanding of these things. But the farther you get away from the farm gate, away from people who do food for a living, the more polarized the voices get. And so, you know, these messages get reduced to, you know, Facebook memes or agenda-driven articles, and those are the things that people rally around. But within the agricultural community, I think this is well understood.
Well, I think it certainly is when you get out to the farms. But having managed associations for years, as I did in agriculture, I know the pressure is on that you have to be very, very strong for your point of view because you believe you're in a process that you have to go in pushing hard for what you want because there's somebody pushing the other way.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
There's a feeling that there is an adversarial kind of relationship in forming policies, and so it keeps driving people to start out with a certain point of view and not start out in the middle, and it's just tricky.
It is tricky, and I've seen that dynamic play out as well. And you know, on the one hand, you totally understand it because like this is their livelihood. When you talk to the pork producers or the Organic Trade Association, they have skin in the game. They're advocacy groups, and I get that. But I still think that all of those groups can have a constructive role in a conversation that's less acrimonious and less polarized.
Well, and I keep hoping, too, that maybe this is where social media will start showing its positive impact. I mean, that you really can get movements, and when you start having, you know, hundreds of thousands that follow you on Facebook or Twitter and you start getting their arms around a point of view that'll have some influence on these conversations, too, in a positive way eventually.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, I can't say I'm terribly optimistic about the role of social media in all of this.
I mean, this really taxes me, too, because I'm one of those glass-half-full people.
Right,
my
right.
Default setting.
You and your fairy dust will make social media work for us.
But I tell you, I really appreciate your taking the time to have this conversation.
I'll talk to anybody about these things anytime. They're very important to me. And I should point out that every time I have a conversation about this with someone who cares about these things, I offload my husband, who is a recipient of so many conversations about agriculture that more than any mere mortal should be forced to listen to.
Before I let you go, why don't you kind of summarize again where people can find you? So if they want to see what you're writing and what you're saying and where you're speaking or anything, how do they find this out?
So my column in the Washington Post is called Unearthed. And so if you Google me and Unearthed, you will find it. And there is a repository of all the columns that I've written. I think it's been 3 years now. But the easiest way is to just follow me on Twitter. I'm at Tamar Haspel, and I tweet out things that I think are interesting, my work and other people's, and I really appreciate engagement in social media because despite the fact that I just made fun of the whole idea that social media can be a force for good, hey, I'm willing to give it the old college try.
Well, I hope you'll tweet out to have people listen to us in this conversation.
I most certainly will.
I'm going to get it up soon, and it's just been a delight talking to you. So, Tamar Haspel.
Thanks so much for having me, Roger.
Yeah, thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on SoundCloud. Facebook, and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.